Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Chemed Podcast, brought to you by the Chemetic Means of Production. I'm your host, Robert Bishara. Today's special guest is Hassan Khan, an Egyptian multimedia artist, musician, and writer who works with choreography, performance, sculpture, sound, photography, and video to create narratives. Hassan has had solo exhibitions of his work worldwide in Paris, Berlin, Dubai, Madrid, Beirut, Cairo, Rotterdam, Sao Paulo, Istanbul, London, Vienna, and Toronto, to name just a few examples. Hi, Hassan, how are you?
Hey, good to be here.
Thank you for joining me today.
That's
So,
my pleasure.
Hassan, you clearly work with many media, sound, video, sculpture, literature. Tell us about the significance of working with various media as an artist and if there's an overall idea driving all of your artistic projects.
Actually, in a way, it's partially because of how things started. I studied literature at the American University in Cairo. I entered university. I was quite young. I was 15. And I was suddenly exposed to, I went from being a school kid to a university student at the age of 15. So you can imagine there was an explosion of sort of impulses and stimuli and different kind of experiences. So during that period, which was a very, very rich period, everything kind of got mixed up together. Music, writing. I was a literature student, so I had an interest in literature and writing, weird films, everything kind of mixed together. And I have to say that, and partially also because of my upbringing earlier, even like I was exposed to a lot of cultural material, which was never defined as, in terms of genre, really. It was all like a big kind of cloud of ideas and forms. And I guess during this university period, this very, very dynamic and explosive and turbulent university period between the ages of 15 and 20, these influences kind of got like mashed up. And I started also playing music and started doing things and getting involved with other also like-minded people. And so without thinking about it, I just found myself making things and doing things. And at that time, I didn't label it. It was more an attitude as well, And so, slowly out of this, it became a bit more professionalized with time as I started like meeting audiences outside just circles of friends. And I never kind of stuck to the labels. And so with time, as I gained experience in different mediums, and as I also started to understand how to work with forms and how to work with people who work with forms. So, I do work with a lot of forms, which I do not necessarily work with, with my own hands myself. Some I do and some I don't. And so I do work with a lot of people, whether they're musicians, whether they're craftspeople. For example, I work with glass. And when I work with glass, I don't work with glass myself, but I work with glass blowers and glass. Almost the relationship almost becomes of a director with an actor, almost, So yeah, maybe this gives a sense of where I started from. And in terms of the general kind of idea that pushes or is behind the work, this is a very, very difficult question, because of course there are many ideas, but of course it's also changing throughout, over the duration of time, through experiences. And one last thing I'd like to say is that in terms again of this idea of formats or mediums and the work, is that every work kind of finds the medium it needs. So some works make sense to be made as moving image works. Some works make sense to be materially present in the space. Some works make sense to be kind of performative. So it really depends on what the work wants to do. I know it sounds a bit strange to divorce it from my own intentions, but there is some kind of distance and intimacy at the same time. I don't know if this gives a sense, maybe.
Yeah. What was the first medium that you worked with? Was it music or?
Yeah, I guess I started with music. I started like bashing on a guitar, you know,
Yeah.
basically. And I
That's in the
think it ha
90s, right?
that's in the 90s. And I think this has to do with also being so young and suddenly like thrown into you know, a much more adult environment, and sort of being influenced by that moment. So yeah, I would say music. It started with music. And but slowly, you know, somehow because of also the weird community that was, you know, created within this bubble of AUC at the time in mid nine in the early 90s. Because of that, you know, this music, this idea of music became expanded. So, you know, we'd organize a sort of party that didn't want to be a party, but, you know, wanted to be an experience of some sort. And that kind of, I guess, led to also experiments with images. And then I also had a very good friend at the time, Amr Hosni, and, you know, he was a photographer. So we started doing we started mixing text and image and then sound and image and, you know, stuff like that. I also started working with Ahmed Al-Attar, who was a theater director at the time. And I was very, very influenced by witnessing, actually, this was quite an important experience for me, by witnessing how he worked with actors, which was messy in a way. And, you know, the world of actors is very messy.
Yeah.
But part of what I did, you know, he invited me to work with him in terms of music. And part of what I did a lot of these exercises with them where I would be playing, you know, music and they would be telling stories or, you know, doing certain things. And what you watch then is you watch these neuroses, you know. It's kind of like upper middle class neuroses kind of coming to the surface. But it's not just that. It's not just that. I mean, that's the context in a way, but it's also whatever is driving people and whether they're social or personal, they all start to come out. And the experience of watching this happening with these young actors who are also sort of friends, but at the same time, you know, being behind the stimulus because this music was kind of like, I think this is why Ahmed got me in there in some ways. He was like kind of using this music to induce some kind of fragility and transparency in a way that wasn't very precise, but that also was kind of explosive. And that was very important for me to just watch people expose themselves in this way and to see how music can induce that. So this opened a lot of things that I discovered later on,
Yeah, it
also in terms
opens the
of working with
possibilities
actors.
of yeah, you're the music in a different context and with different people, different forms and it kind of opens up possibilities that music can be more than just music in a sense. And you were experimenting, I guess, early on with noise, right? As
Yeah,
well, right?
that's true. And I was drawn, I guess I was drawn to the chaos somehow. And
Yeah.
yeah, I mean, of course, it was also a time there was a lot of drug usage and a lot of yeah, a lot of interest in the visceral. And
Yeah.
I guess that was part of it. Because I was also drawn very much to, you know, at the time to that kind of experimental cinema. And, you know, I mean, I guess at the time, art itself, as in, you know, contemporary art was a bit distant, but things like, yeah, like cinema and music and theater were very close. Yeah, I guess
So
so.
actually, that brings me to my next question. What were the works of art that influenced you growing up around that time? How and when did you realize that art is your path and passion?
Yeah, okay. So it's connected to what I was just saying. I mean, it again, it's a mix. So I guess the if you want to like put it as art, so maybe I was kind of influenced by Abdelhadi Gozor in the 90s. He's an Egyptian painter, and I guess that and William Blake, you know, which is not surprising if you look at these two painters. I think there is some kind of relation. But I was also like very much influenced by, you know, Louis Buñuel, or you know, watching Solaris in the I don't remember what it was called, the film series, the classic film series, you know, in 91 or something, like, kind of blew my mind. But at the same time, you know, so there was this mix of influences. I'm trying to think of names. As I said, it wasn't really artists, it was more, you know, musicians. Jimi Hendrix was a big influence, and I think that in a way, I want to bring up Jimi Hendrix not because of the type of music, but because of his understanding of the guitar, that not just as a melodic instrument. I think that was very influential upon me, more than the actual music he was making, this idea. But then there's also, and I mentioned
The
a
use of
moment ago,
effects and pedals and
yeah, but
extending the
also,
guitar.
yeah, but also, like, the idea of feedback. I guess it was just, like, basically the fact that it's not about a specific pitch. It's about, you know, creating a soundscape, and this idea, and that the instrument is not just there to play, you know, melodies as such, but it can become something else. And
Sonic
this,
sculptures, right?
in a
Like kind of,
way, in a way, I think this was influential. But then I also mention him a lot. Yacine Touhami was very influential on me at the time, because I started listening to him also when I was around 16, 17, and it really blew my mind. At the time, in the early 90s, I was very, you know, like, critical of Arab pop and, like, Egyptian pop. It seemed to be very, you know, uninteresting for me or for my sensibility. It was like bubblegum pop. And but when I first listened to Yacine Touhami, who's a munshid, who comes out of a sort of, like, you know, this sounds a bit fashionable, but it's the reason, but, like, a sort of mystical tradition, of a religious mystical tradition. So it's also, like, very clear. But what was, I mean, what blew my mind when I just listened to him, because I listened to him first, like, just on cassette tapes. And what blew my mind was, you know, like, yes, he has an incredible voice, but also the poetry was, you know, very powerful. But it was really the mix of how he sings the poetry. So, which is to me similar to this idea of an extended instrument. So he uses his voice not just to deliver, you know, or to make it pretty or to sing, you know, beautifully. He uses his voice to unpack the meanings of the words. So, or to even, like, counter the meanings of the words. So maybe he would, you know, he would sing the word, something like, using the word, masalan, bust, which is, like, you know, stretched, and maybe he would say it in a very, like, concise, like, shout it out, you know? And he had, like, an incredible range and an ability to, so basically he used his voice almost, again, in this sculptural way, but very much related to the text. And that was a very, very powerful experience. I'm analyzing it now. I think then it was just, again, visceral and powerful, but it definitely had an influence upon me.
You almost seem to suggest that it's like Sufi Shabi music, and you're suggesting that there's something avant-garde about his performance that people kind of maybe don't notice that right away.
Yeah, I mean, we don't have to call it avant-garde or not, but there's definitely something. It is, I mean, Yacine Touhami, in one sense, is very classical because he comes from a certain tradition, but at the same time, the usage is, for me, not dead. It's alive, which means that, which by definition for me means, in any art form, if you want to use the word avant-garde, we can say it's avant-garde. If it's alive, it means it's also questioning its own tools, and it's also, like, pushing them and exploring. And I do think he is an artist, and he's a master at what he's doing, and he's definitely doing that. So this had a big influence on me. Shabi music also had an influence on me, but later, not at this time, not in the 90s. It came later. Yeah.
I'm thinking of
because, I just want to
Antonín
say,
Artaud.
Oh yeah. Yes, that's a
because
good.
You were talking
Yeah.
about visceral, right? The visceral, and that's something that he was against, sort of the intellectual type of theater. He wanted the audience to have a reaction. And, you know, the theater of cruelty is that. And it sounds like the way you're describing his performance and the aesthetic that you're going for is that you want the audience to not to be indifferent, but to have a reaction, whether it's positive or negative, but to feel something, to feel something in their bodies.
Yeah, definitely. Yes. I mean, I'm also speaking about that time. My ideas have also changed with time, but we're talking about these early influences. And just one thing also to mention that has to do with popular Egyptian culture, because popular Egyptian culture is I think very fascinating and complex, and also very contradictory. On one hand, you have, you know, on one hand, it seems to be very sterile and formalized, and you have, you know, like bubblegum pop, you have like these long, you know, old long form operatic type singing, you have whatever, these different formats. And there always seemed to be a lack of like actual anger, you know, like in these formats. But then you find anger coming out in all the informal formats. So whether it is Friday sermons, you know, by completely rabid, you know, preachers, whatever they're saying, I'm just speaking here formally, whatever they're saying, but I always understood these kind of the craziness of Cairo on Friday when everybody's like screaming out of the mosque, you know, on these megaphones. This is an expression of anger in some ways that is not allowed to be visible in formal culture, you know. This is a bit different now, by the way. I think things have changed, but I'm talking about the 90s. And the same with Shaabi music. In some ways, there's a space where anger comes out, but not in pop, not in formal language, you know. So this contradiction always, I think, was intriguing for me, and I was always looking for that space of anger. And when it came, I was always kind of interested in it, because it suggests, you know, I think, the possibility of formal sophistication, which I think happened in Shaabi music at a certain time.
Yeah, and it seems to me that you are sort of like to talk about the Friday prayer. Most people will focus on the content of the speech, but you're listening to the form, the performance, and the aesthetic in a way, and trying to reflect on that.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I do not want to dismiss the content, because the content is very problematic, of course. Mostly, I guess it's problematic, and but yes, I'm also understanding the form, and I'm trying to understand what, and I actually, this goes throughout my whole like kind of arc. What can I learn from the form, you know? And so if any form interests me, whatever it is, if it's a postcard I find in the street, if it's a crazy sermon I hear somewhere, where it doesn't have to be in Egypt, also in other places, but we're talking about the 90s, whatever form interests me, I think that the fact that it interests me means, for me at least, means that there is something there that I find important, and I'm trying to understand that. It does not mean embracing the form and believing it, but it's also like about trying to understand why is it happening? What is it coming out of? Because these forms are also, again, and this happens with music as well, they're collective forms. They also are part of a collective culture. And, you know, I'm also in this strange dichotomy of being an individual artist engaging with a collective culture, and, you know, that's also an interesting place.
Right. How much of it is your personal creation? How much of it is some kind of influence on you that's unconscious that you're expressing, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's always there. That's always there. But also, like, how come, you know, inherited codes that, you know, create any kind of genre or form, how come they both, you know, celebrate the system they come out of, but also have the potential to undo it? This also for me is kind of a fascinating issue.
So I want to ask you about your solo exhibition from 2003, 17, and in AUC, because that is the first work by you that I have encountered. Mind you, that was 20 years ago today, right?
It's, yeah.
Think about that. So I don't know if much of it you remember, but
I remember.
Tell us about the project and how it came together, because I thought it was fascinating.
Yes, well, 17 AC 2003, which was exactly 8 years after I had graduated. So AUC is the American University in Cairo,
right?
And I was invited by Scott Bailey, who was then a professor at the American University in Cairo, to do an exhibition at AUC. And I was like a bit like thinking about what should I do, and in the end I decided that, you know, I was ready to somehow face this formative period in my life, but I was also interested in looking at the institution itself. So the project also, just to give a quick description for, you know, whoever might be listening to this, the project was a performance that took place over 14 nights. I built a one-way mirrored room so people could, you know, see the person inside, but the person inside was isolated. It was soundproofed. They could not see. They could only see reflections of themselves. This room was mic'd and amplified so people could hear what that person is saying. And every day for these 14 nights, for 4 hours, I stepped inside that room. I locked myself in. I had a table. I had a chair. I had a supply of beer. I was a smoker then. I could smoke. And I sat there and I had a few rules I had to follow. I sat there to speak and I spoke about my memories of being a student in this university. But I had three rules. The rules were, one, I could only speak about what I remember, so like really direct memories. I did this, I did that. Two, I could speak about what these memories mean, or I could try to think about them. So I could also speak about this. I could think out aloud about these memories. And three, I could speak about the experience I'm having at the moment, like being in that room, being isolated, not knowing if anybody's watching me or not. So these were my three rules. And this was, I think these rules were very important because I didn't want to just sit in a box, get drunk in this weird place and just rant, you know? Mm-hmm. It was really about trying to create a space, an architectural space that was like a technology of the mind somehow. Mm. So being in that room, and being in that room was like a really, it was a crazy experience for me to do. There were 56 hours in total that I went through in this crazy room. And it was really strange because time passed in a very, very different, you know, there was a very different sense of time. And, you know, I don't know, I passed through a lot of personal experiences, but I think also it was about how to address an audience, because people, you know, were watching me. I guess you witnessed this, so you have your own experience of it. But I do know from some people who spoke to me afterwards that, for example, when they would look, you know, and they would look straight in my eye, but my eye would not register them because, you know, I cannot see them. I only see a reflection of myself. That this experience, you know, this changes something in the relation of communication. You know, we are constantly in this kind of registering each other. And if one person is speaking without this registering, but they're actually present, I think this transforms the whole relationship. You know, it's not like being on stage. It's not like being in a screen because you're actually there. So it creates a space that is kind of like, it's a bracketed space. It's as if you're inside of a box that is, you know, it's in the same dimension, but it's also partially not. And I think that this little change in the relationship was important for the act of like remembering and kind of looking at an institution. So I'm addressing my own memories, and it's very personal, but these memories of one individual who went to this institution in 1990 and graduated in 1995, all of these experiences are also about what this institution means, you know, within the city it's in. So I think, or I would like to claim, that this was not just about me as Hassan and what I happened to me, but also a way of trying to understand what an institution means, not as a building and not as a straightforward history, but also as a technology of producing people, you know. Mm-hmm. And that room that I built, that was, you know, for this performance, is in a way a technology for kind of mining into that construction. So at least these were my hopes.
Yeah, so there was the live performance piece, but then there was an exhibit at the Falaki, right? After the performance, you edited down the all
I didn't
the footage.
I didn't edit it. What we did is, okay, so there was two things. One, you know, I was invited to do the show in the university, but university policy meant you cannot consume alcohol in the university.
All right.
Number one. So, you know, we came up with this method, you know, so it's also reacting to the parameters you're working in. So, you know, I found this apartment, this empty apartment. We rented this empty apartment. We constructed this room in this empty apartment. We did the performance there. This was in the city. And it was not, and this was important for me, it was not announced. It was announced by word of mouth, but it was not like there was no poster, there was nothing like that for that performance. The door was left ajar intentionally.
And this is before social media, so
this is before social media, exactly. And this was partially because this performance was, you know, I spoke mostly in English because it also has to do with my experiences in this university. And I had a little bit of a, you know, a question about creating a public performance in Cairo that was spoken English in this way. So I kind of intentionally designed it to be half a secret in a way, and people could find it. But then, you know, the performance had to come back to the university. And so the solution was to have 14 nights in the Falaki and for like to mirror the performance. And every night, the 4 hours of the nights were just broadcast. So it was like a documentation. I think of that exhibition as a sort of like embodied documentation. You know? The performance happened and then it was broadcast. And then, you know, I have no idea. Students then could see that and could hear. And, you know, of course, this was interesting for me because when it goes back into the university, it's kind of like it's ruminating on being in that university. And then it's being seen by students who are there now or then, you know. So that was kind of important. Yeah.
And for me, as someone who's committed to psychoanalysis, I think it's really good exercise at free association, too. And so, I love what you said about technology of the mind. I love that expression. So the next project that you made that I remember being struck by was a four-way video installation at the townhouse, although I think it was in Rawabit Space in downtown Cairo. The four videos were synchronized to play together for about 1 hour. Was that the time to
it's not one, it's 52 minutes, I think.
Or 52 minutes. Or
something like that.
So the 2004 four-channel video projection was titled The Hidden Location. I found it fascinating. I haven't seen anything since that exciting in terms of using four screens and synchronizing four videos for that amount of time. And I wish more people could experience it. Can you tell us more about this project and if at all is inspired by Mark Figgis's Time Code, because that's the only reference I could think of before
I saw Time Code, but I don't remember when it was. Was
2000. It? Yeah, I think it was 2000.
So possibly, I don't know if it was a conscious influence, but The Hidden Location came at a moment. It was produced in 2004. It actually was shown a bit later in Cairo. It was shown in other places, and then it finally came to Cairo, I think, in 2008. The Hidden Location came at a time. So it was 2004. It was after the 17 AUC, and I was at this moment where previous work, I'd done a lot of videos and stuff that like had... You know, in the 90s, I did things that were a bit instinctual. And then in the early 2000s, I did things that were a bit more about looking at the world around you and analyzing it. And then 2003 with 17 AUC, I kind of wanted to go back to the self in a way. And then in 2004, I had this desire to really work with, you know, to sum up in some ways what I had been doing. So The Hidden Location was a little bit about this. It was about working with video and to create a system that, you know, these four channels, but they're not just four channels because there are 16 sequences within the four channels. So every sequence has a different type of language. So there are sequences with actors that are a bit like, you know, fictional scenes. There are sequences with people like, you know, that we invited from the street to pose and say some things. There were sequences that were more geographical, like kind of watching the ships crossing the Suez Canal. So every sequence had a different logic, had a different way of constructing a relationship between the four screens, and had a different working process. So it was as if you created 16 different kinds of mini projects and put them together in one big system. And I didn't mention Adib Shabib. I don't know if you know Adib Shabib. Mahmoud Abdul Razak Afifi. So Adib
No,
al-Shibani
not
Abdul Razak
sure.
Afifi, he's a sort of an outside writer, outsider writer, Egyptian outsider writer, who in the 90s was like writing graffiti all over the streets, challenging the authorities, challenging Naguib Mahfouz, challenging, you know, all these things, and like very megalomaniac things, and quoting quotes from his books, which were very weird. And I read one of his books called Ighod al-Hurriya and The Abortion of Freedom. And it was, yeah, it was totally, it was like, yes, clearly someone who was not, you know, who was, you know, facing a lot of problems. So it was a mixture of fantasies, of erotic fantasies, of political diatribes, of religious exegesis, of just weird letters, of insecurities, of megalomania, you know, like all of this. And what fascinated me about this book was that it felt like you were plunging directly into, I'm not going to call it the subconscious, but you're plunging directly into like the complexes of the whole city, you know, just like they're just like expressed like that, you know, somehow, you know, this guy, whatever, I don't know personally, but somehow he's compelled to sort of put everything on the page. And somehow by doing this, you kind of get a strange portrait of the logic of the city itself with its completely crazy contradictions. So that book, for example, played a big role in The Hidden Location because I used it. I worked with the actor Said Ragab then, and I used, so I made, we created a sequence where he's an insurance salesman who's going through the street and having different encounters. But the logic of that was that I had read the book, and I boiled down the book into like a series of complexes, like phrases. And then I gave these to Sayed, and we worked together to produce the character who would have the logic of these phrases. So in a way, you're watching a sort of, and then it was shot as if it was a documentary. So basically Sayed did this thing, and then me and my sister actually went down with two cameras. He was mic'd, and we were shooting him in real life as if it's a documentary, following this insurance salesman, you know, buying cigarettes, meeting someone in a tea shop, and sort of like ranting about women, you know, very misogynistically, going into a computer shop and trying to sell them insurance. And in all these encounters, these complexes that me and him worked on are at play. So in a way, you know, without referring to the book directly, I kind of used this book to produce this character and to sort of like look at it. So this was kind of, The Hidden Location is full of different kind of sequences that work in different ways. But I guess the whole work is about touching that layer. And the title, The Hidden Location, is also a bit about this, you know, layer, but also because every time the sequence ends and a sequence starts, you know, the screens all change at the same time because they're synchronized. And I feel like there is a jump there. So if you are right now, let's say you're listening to a human resources executive in a multinational insurance company, and she's speaking about the exercises that new employees do. The exercises that employees do to like get along together. She's explaining sort of like the way human resources work in a multinational corporation. And then, you know, and on the other screens, there are people who are recreating their first day at work. And, you know, so there is this kind of strange relation. And then it switches all together. And then you're faced with, you know, teenagers who are reciting a chorus about like a sort of violent sexual encounter. And then in this jump, it's a jump in place, but it's also the jump of logic of how things are organized. And it's a jump of, in that jump, there is a hidden gap between that sequence and that sequence, an invisible place that you have to also, your brain has to jump from that to that to understand things differently. And to me, that's also the hidden location. So I don't know, I'm being very abstract. I feel this is not going to make sense to anyone.
But in a sense, you're kind of, I mean, not to reduce it too much, but you're capturing the complexity of Cairo in a way through this form of the four screens and the complex stories and the source material that's already complex. In a way, you said that it kind of captures the logic, the chaotic logic of the city. And how hard was it? Because it's like making four films and then synchronizing like the post-production process and putting all of this together. I imagine it was really difficult as a project.
It was quite difficult, also because in 2004 computers were much slower, so
yeah,
it was really heavy
rendering and all of that, yeah.
Rendering and files on top of each other, and I had to, you know, so it was a bit crazy. I don't remember exactly. I didn't. I think I did do some tests at home with like four monitors and stuff like that. But I guess I just had the different things on the timeline, on the, you know, four timeline, and I was just switching back and forth and trying to edit this way and like
right.
learning.
And for the exhibition, was it like four DVD players that had to be played at the same time? Something like that?
Yeah, for the exhibition, I mean, now it's much easier, but at the
Right.
time there is something called like a video synchronizer. So
Okay.
You used it and you use like special DVD players. At the time it was DVD players, special DVD players that can be synchronized together with the synchronizer. So that's what we did in
yeah, pulling this off back then, I mean,
it was
kudos.
difficult.
Yeah.
But
So
you know, actually, because my first exhibition in Cairo, which was in 1999, which was called I'm a Hero, You're a Hero, was in the Gezira Art Center. And that was on VHS tape. Okay. And that was five monitors next to each other. And there was no synchronizer or anything. So at the time, the way I did that piece is that it was more like a fugue, you know? They were
Okay.
like sort of supposed to run together, and you sort of like use remote controls to press play, and they all kind of start together, but you
Yeah.
know that they will kind of lag off.
There's delay and counterpoint and
Yeah, but you kind of like also design it already knowing that. So you kind of like allow it to be fugue-like. So yeah,
so it works in
that's
a way, even though it's not super synchronized.
Yeah, that but that was 99. So yeah.
In 2007, I attended the album release party for your tabla dub at the Contemporary Image Collective in Cairo. The album was
Yeah.
released on the experimental label 100 Copies, founded by Mahmoud Rifat, someone you collaborated with a number of times, probably since the 90s. Your work with electronic music, in my opinion, prefigured some of what we now call electro shabi, because I
Right.
remember you being one of the first to sample traditional Egyptian instruments and musical styles. So what are your thoughts on this assessment? I mean, that's my experience having seen you do this work before it became like a huge
Yeah,
sort of subgenre or whatever.
yeah. Sure. No, I do think there is some truth to what you're saying. There are some differences. So I would say that Tabla Dub was released in 2007, but actually it was produced in 2001.
Oh,
And
wow.
I had been performing it live for 6 years before it was actually released. And I did do concerts of it before there was release concert in Cairo and other places. I traveled and I did a lot of concerts with it. And Tabla Dub came, actually it was produced in 2001 when I came back. I was in a trip to the US and I came back right before September 11th. And I was totally jet lagged. And I think I arrived on September 9th, you know, something like that. But
Okay.
I came back to Cairo. I was totally jet lagged. I couldn't sleep. September 11th happened, which was kind of dramatic. And I don't remember, like 2 or 3 weeks, I just produced this album at home all night. You know, I just couldn't sleep. I was jet lagged. And this came out. And the idea was a little bit like, I had before that, I had been working with the, you know, noise, as I mentioned. I also had been working with feedbacking mixers a little bit, with different kinds of electronica. I used to have a four channel before I had a computer. I had a four track, a Tascam four track tape recorder that I did a lot of stuff with, using small like toy Casio tones and live mics and drums and blah blah blah, all of this stuff. And then in 2001, actually, by then I had a computer, and that made it that's kind of like I produced Tabla Dub on Pro Tools. And I was never a fan of sampling as such, because I not in general. I have nothing, no problems with sampling, but just in my own work, I was always interested in trying to produce things myself. But in the case of tabla dub, it is sampled because all of the beats were taken from, you know, tabla sort of CDs, you know, or belly dancing CDs or different sources. But I wanted to play with them to like really take them and micro edit them. So there's a lot of micro editing to kind of like create new beats out of them. And in a way, because I guess at the time, I mean, I can play a little bit of percussion, but not good enough. And I didn't have the means at the time to like go to a studio and work with actual lot of, so that was kind of the solution to sort of like sample the shit out of like, and to kind of, and the idea was not, you know, fusion or, you know, East meet West or anything, because I was always super critical of this. The idea was to play, you know, I was thinking of like the tabla as an instrumental foundational element of Egyptian music, and to play it as if, you know, I was also like very influenced by dub. Yeah, I have to say it's also called tabla dub, but I was very influenced by dub, you know, by Jamaican dub. And what I loved about Jamaican dub is the fact that the studio is the instrument, and in a sense, the, you know, it's also like the musical culture is the instrument. So, you know, they're deconstructing reggae in Jamaican dub in a way, like reggae is the form, the popular form, and then dub becomes this ghost of it. And that fascinated me. And like with tabla dub, I kind of wanted to do this with the tabla, not to imitate, you know, the sound of Jamaican dub, but the logic of like, you know, yes, the Pro Tools is going to be my instrument here. So I'll take the tabla, I'll chop it up, I'll make new beats, I will, you know, like distort it, I'll do different things to it. And in a way, it becomes as if you're playing the musical culture. That was kind of how I described it at the time, at least. So yes, I don't know if this specific project prefigures this electro chabi thing. I don't know. But what I can say is that in 2009, I had like the big one, Al-Wahda Kibira, which was, which started off as a soundtrack for, or like the sessions, it was like made from the same sessions of the sessions I did for a soundtrack for one of Al-Tor's performances, actually. But it's not the same music, it's just from the same sessions. And, you know, that was also the time when I noticed that Egyptian shabi was mutating, like in 2007, 2000, basically 2005, 2006, 2007, this like, there was, it's a wave that also disappeared, like with the rise of Mahroganet in the beginning of like 2009, 2010, 2011, this wave, there was a really a very interesting wave of very, very kind of crazy different directions. Also like people doing things at home and stuff like that, that kind of became homogenized into Mahroganet, you know? But that's the story of like how popular culture works. You know, there's always a moment where things become super interesting, and then it becomes kind of like commodified into a known sound, and then it kind of dies in a way because of repetition and etc. And then something else arises. I think it's a natural pattern. But anyway, in this shabby like moment of 2005, 2006, 2007, there was a lot of like interesting and like organic experiments. So it felt like people were naturally doing this. They were taking the form and messing it up. And it's also the influence of, you know, technology of like computers becoming more accessible to a much wider strata of the society. And as I told you earlier, you know, I'm learning from forms. So I felt like I started learning from what was happening in the culture itself, and then I'm interested in doing it in my own language. So that's what the big one was. You know, I started like doing this. So it was like kind of, it's as if I'm playing shabi, which is related to what I'm doing now, sort of with hip hop. You know, kind of. It's a similar kind of relation. And yes, when I premiered this piece, Al-Wahda Kibira, in 2009, I think at the time, for that kind of crowd who would go to like a concert like this, this was completely new. But of course, it comes out of something that already existed in the collective culture.
Yeah.
And that maybe they listen to and, you know, they hear it on the street all the time. But I think the fact that then, you know, I'm taking this and, you know, speaking it in another language, And it's not sampling because there, like with the Wahda Kibira, everything I did, I went to the studio and I worked with like musicians and I worked with arrangers and I worked with the whole setup. So it wasn't sampled, it was produced, learning from their language, but trying to speak it in a different way. I don't know. And then, yeah, it's become, it, I mean, that style became very, very popular afterwards.
You did mention Atar, so actually my next question is about collaborations. You've collaborated with several other artists. We mentioned already Mahmoud Rafat, but particularly theater director Ahmed Al-Attar and filmmaker Nadine Khan. Tell us about your approach to scoring plays and films. I loved your soundtrack for the 2012 film Chaos Disorder. And
Thanks.
also Attar's Mother, I Want to Be a Millionaire from 2004 was a massive influence on me. I've seen it a few times when it was premiered at AUC. So, your approach to scoring, your philosophy, how do you approach it?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Score. I mean, first, as I mentioned, I've been working with Ahmed since the early '90s.
Yeah.
So even before, before I did the score for Oedipus the President, he had already done some plays, and that was in '96. But I'd been already been working with him since '93. So I worked with him 3 years. And with Ahmed, of course, the relationship grew over the years. In the beginning, it was a bit problematic. It was a bit, we clashed a lot in the beginning. And, I remember we had like this moment, like it was on a quarter inch reel, the Oedipus the President, that first soundtrack, which was actually done on this Tascam 4-track. And then, kind of bounced on an 8-channel Tascam that they had at the university. But anyway. But I mean, we had a difference in opinion and I threatened to burn the tape, it was like, so, but this changed with time as one grows older and hopefully a slightly wiser. And I learned, okay, it's his stuff, I now my approach is that I try to basically achieve what the director wants, of course, but because the people I've collaborated with are all very close. So yes, Ahmed, I worked with him since 30 years now. Nadine is my sister. I also did a soundtrack for Karima Mansour in 2001, I think, who's a dancer, an Egyptian dancer and choreographer. So basically, like with Ahmed, also now over years we've worked together so long that it's almost now we don't really talk. It's almost, he starts something, he tells me about it. I see a few rehearsals. We discuss something. I go and work on it and he listens to it. And it's almost always like it's done, more or less, And with my sister, it was really geared towards, how the film worked. And with Nadine Khan, I shouldn't say, let's make it official. So with Nadine Khan's film, Chaos Disorder, it was really geared towards how the film worked and the idea of using these piano melodies to intercut the film, but also with the intro and the outro to almost create a structural joke. So you kind of hear this happy, jittery melody happening. It's a little bit pushed, it's a little bit too mechanical. It's a little bit to be really sentimental. It's like sentimentality as in quotes in a way.
It's ironic, right?
I don't know if it's ironic, but there's a quotation there,
Okay.
It's playing with it. And then it gets, deconstructed in a way because the melody then, different parts of the notes are taken out. So it's almost like a joke, kind of. Like the structure of a joke is like da, 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 you take something out, take something out, take something out until you're not almost left with nothing. And then the world of the film was all done on gamelan. So it's like two very, very separate thing. And then that has a totally different atmosphere. And she wanted to have two layers. She wanted to have the layer of the narration, which is the intertitles and the intro and the outro. And that's this kind of piano that creates a certain, I don't know if it's irony, but a strange relation to sentimentality and distance and something. And then the world of the film itself, the actions, which we use the gamelan, because also she didn't want to accent it with like a specifically Egyptian instrument, for example. So the gamelan sort of, because it's percussive but melodic, it became kind of an ideal area to play around with tones and to create expectations and to like underline characters and things like that. So that was a bit the logic. But basically, yeah, my relation is like I try to serve the people I work with and produce something that ideally would make the work itself as a whole work best.
You're
That's
an author is like Philip Glass with Godfrey Reggio, like that kind of or even
the
Philip Glass with Robert Wilson, that kind of like iconic duo. That's how I see it.
Okay.
Talk to us about your 2012 black and white film Blind Ambition, which was shot using two mobile phones. I think it's stunning and genuinely ambitious in terms of what you accomplish. I remember the handheld cinematography being dynamic and engaging, mainly how you capture the streets of Cairo, the traffic, and the public transportation. How did you conceive of this project and how did you realize it?
Yeah, okay. So Blind Ambition, it has a it ha first of all, I love this title, Blind Ambition, and I've used it for many different works and shows that are not connected, but anyway. But Blind Ambition, the film, has a long history or a source in the 90s again, because I had like in one of my notes, and I even shot these one sequence. I had like this fantasy of a film where the opening shots would be empty, like streets at dawn. And overlaid with the sound of like the whole city recorded for 24 hours in multi-track. So like an insanely noisy kind of thing overlaid on this empty streets. And that was sort of like the opening sequence of a film that never happened that I was thinking about in the 90s. And then with 2012, with this film Blind Ambition, I had been, thinking for a while that I wanted to do a film that was silent and then dubbed. And in the beginning, I actually, my project also had this idea of like using voice actors and body actors, not the same actors. So you would dub these actors onto these actors. And partially the idea was to like work on the voice in a way that is different to the body. And so you would disconnect them, but that when you're watching, you would watch this person speak as if it's the same voice. And sort of this disconnect would allow to really explore, personality in a way. So there were these ideas, but this is not what I did, but these were the ideas in the background. And then Blind Ambition, the film, came out of, observation. So it's really, a sequence, it's again a series of like the Hidden Location, a series of disconnected sequences that all happen in Cairo and that all happen in public places. And that happen at different times of the day in different parts of the city, but they all happen in public places. And they were all driven by these sequences were driven by observations and mostly moments and words I heard or snippets of moments and like when you're walking down the street and you pass someone and you hear something and things like that. So they were really came out of that, or even when you look and you see one moment, so like one moment would become the germ of a scene, for example. But it was born with the actors. This is really important. So, I had, these little germs of ideas. And then, I did a lot of casting and I was very careful in who I chose to work with. And then for each sequence, I worked with these actors, not on character, but on relation, on how the logic of relation, a bit like in the Hidden Location with Said, it's not about creating a character, it's about the logic of how you communicate. But the moment you do that, a character is born. That you don't need to get into, you don't need to try to explain this character, but if you just focus on the dynamics of communication, that character just comes. This, I think, has to do with how we're constructed, maybe as human beings. But anyway, so I worked with the actors, all in, like I have, it's not really a technique, but a method sort of working with actors, which involves first conversations that are kind of confidential between me and different actors. And then, you know, we work with exercises, work with different things. I introduce the actors together, we work together, etc. And out of this work, you know, these germs of situations were developed into actual dialogues, sequences, details. And then they were then introduced into the street and then shot. So, you know, for example, the two girls are having a fight. You know, I worked with them in like just a rehearsal studio and, you know, built the relation between them. And then even in rehearsals, we then did some rehearsals where they would go down the street and they would be like mic'd, like wireless mic'd, and I would have just headphones to listen to them, no camera or anything. And, you know, they would have these conversations in the street while I'm listening to them, and then I would give them notes about it and we shape it. And then ultimately, when we came to shoot, we just went to the location first time for them. And, you know, I drew a path for them as like, okay, you walk from here to there. And in that path, this relation will unfold. And we did this sequence, you know, a few times. They just walk and, you know, I'm shooting them by just like, you know, kind of like observing them. And it's not directing in the sense of I'm not blocking them and I'm not stopping and I'm not saying action and cut. And, you know, it's not that. It's more like you're so basically what's happening in the film is that I work with the actors. We produce a fictional world between them. And then we insert this fictional world into the real world. And then I'm documenting that. Again, it's similar to the hidden location in that way. But the editing is a bit different because in Blind Ambition, I mostly relied on this idea of editing, you know, using cuts to produce real time, which is, sounds a bit contradictory because usually, you know, cuts are used to create a more concise sense of time. But I was interested in mostly not just having, you know, like static long shots, etc., but sort of like really using the cut as a way of giving depth to the scene and allowing the viewer to sense details and to see details, but to also maintain this feeling of real time, that this, the time you're watching something take place is the time it's really taking place. And I think the prime example for this are maybe two scenes. The first scene with the advertising, sort of the people who work in this company who are like having coffee and discussing things together. It's full of cuts, but it's very slow also. It really follows the conversation. But at the same time, it's it keeps cutting to, you know, details. And it's, so it's kind of creating continuity with cuts, but trying to keep the time the same. And also the scene with the group of young men who are like arguing about some guy who borrowed money from the other guy. And that is also in a shot in a similar way. You know, it's also being documented, but it's also like full of these cuts that are trying to, in a way, analyze the situation, but not simplify it. I guess that's the goal, to analyze and not simplify it. And I don't intellectualize these goals so much. It's more like when I'm working, it's like I have a sense of how I do things, but now I can analyze them later.
Well, you know, one sense I get, I mean, I don't want to say it's like an anti-film or something like that, but, you know, your method sounds a little bit anthropological. Like you're always interested in city and the people and somehow capturing that and recreating it, but also being aware that it's fictional, not trying to pretend that this is real. So there's a distance, obviously, but I was going to ask you how much of it is scripted and how much of it is improvised. I think you answered that question. One thing I noticed about the editing was there were these transitional jump cuts that were very intriguing. Almost felt like, almost felt sci-fi, weirdly enough. Like, it's like we're encountering something that's taking us somewhere else completely. Almost like we encounter a portal that takes us to another dimension. I don't know what was the logic
that
behind
makes
that.
Sense. That
but totally it had that feeling to me.
That totally makes sense. Because that's, again, a bit like this hidden gap in the hidden location. Again, this I basically, these intermissions are all forms of public transport in the city. And they're all shot in the same way that, you know, the entry into the transportation, into the means of transportation is shot, the exit somewhere else is shot, and it's cross-cut. So the beginning and the end are cross-cut. So there's a sense of time being contracted. That's, I guess, the sci-fi element of it. And it's like as if you're sucked here and you're thrown there, kind of.
Yes.
And the idea of having these intermissions, there are like several reasons for them. One was kind of technical, was so that the viewer is like watching a sequence, and then rather than jumping straight to another thing, this interruption will also create a moment where what they've watched can be erased, and they, you know, like a palate cleanser, and then they'll be ready for the next one. And that was one reason. And the other is because it gives a sense of the infrastructure of the shared space. So these modes of transportation, whether it's the subway, the tram, the public bus, the microbus, the tuk-tuk, or the taxi, all of these forms of public transportation, which are again like, yeah, public and shared, and people are moving all day long through them, they become like a grid, you know, or I imagine it like this, like a sort of like a little grid that gives you a sense of where this place is, where all these things are happening. And if you'd notice, there's another important thing about Blind Ambition that was a very conscious choice. There are no establishing shots. So I don't have shots where I look at a building from outside, or, you know, the scene starts by looking at this. It's never like that. It's always bam, straight into the action.
Yeah.
And it like, it doesn't care about trying to explain to you where this is or what is. You know, these are more the classical rules of filmmaking, of building a scene. But it doesn't care about this at all. It just cares about jumping straight into these actions. But then these intertitles or these moments, they're like the infrastructure of the whole city. So that kind of then becomes an invisible layer. And finally, I didn't mention this, but the film is silent except when people speak. So all of the audio has been canceled, and the actors dub themselves afterwards.
Right.
So that creates that very strange, you know, also space that's a bit like a dream in a way. And that was that comes from this 90s film that where you do empty spaces with sound on top of them. But then here it's like it's actually filled spaces with sound taken out. And I think that's really
it must
important.
have been tempting for you to add like ambience from the city or like soundtrack, but for you to resist that temptation,
it wasn't. It was very clear to me I wanted it to be completely silent except when people speak. And of course, when you know, I don't know, you watched it in the cinema or you watched
I haven't seen it in the cinema. I saw it when I actually want to ask you about the context, because it came 1 year after the uprising. And during the presidency of Morsi, and when it came out, there was a feeling watching it that was a kind of a revolutionary film. That's the vibe that it had, like, wow, you know, that's so I don't know if that's an element or not, but it did have that feeling, at least that during that time when I saw it.
I mean, it was not released in the cinema, but it had screenings in different cinemas. Also in Cairo, I screened it. It's the best context for me with this film is being screened in a cinema, not in a gallery or museum space. And in the cinema, it's quite intense because people are sitting there and then there's like the silence and, you know, and then someone speaks. And also, again, you only hear voices. You don't hear
It's like a vacuum
anything.
A little bit.
Exactly. And it creates, I think it creates a sense of unease, of course. And the film is not very long. It's 46 minutes, but, you know, it always feels longer.
No, it's a great project.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you so much. Yeah, I mean, it's really a very dear project for me. Actually, all the projects you mentioned are very important projects for me. So it's kind of nice to look at them. Yeah.
I have a few more I want to ask you about. So, in your introduction to your live performance of your composition Superstructure, you discuss how you work with chaos. Clearly, it's an important concept for you. I'm curious about your philosophy regarding like chaos theory and how central it is for your work, not just that composition, but maybe in general.
Right. I mean, I can't say much about chaos theory because I'm not that well informed, I have to admit. You know, I know a little bit. I have friends who are into, you know, friends who are math geeks, and I had friends a long time ago who were really into fractals. So I can't really speak about chaos theory, but I can say that my interest in like in the introduction to Superstructure, I'm speaking specifically about feedbacking mixers. And what I find interesting in this idea of the feedbacking mixer is the moment you feedback a system, it generates, yes, noise, it generates this chaotic form, but that, you know, your work as an artist is to sort of struggle with this form and to shape it into sense. And I feel that this allows for the possibility to speak in ways that are not just already predetermined. I think that's important, because if we're trying to find out, you know, how we can, I don't know, live in this world, or how we can collectively find better ways to organize our shared life than the present kind of disastrous situation the world is in, then, you know, this kind of thought is important. I believe that. But then also, just again, on the visceral level, it's thrilling to work with this potential for complete failure, because also with, like, you know, with these kind of systems, they are chaotic, which means they can go out of control, and then it's just like a big mess, and it's not really working. So there is that. So there is this give and take, and I think that's exciting. I find that quite exciting. So I guess, I don't know, I didn't really answer your question because of my ignorance of chaos theory, but that's kind of part of where I'm
But it seems to also, so I mean, the way you describe blind ambition and the process, like there's an element of chaos at work there. Like you always kind of leave room for chaos. You don't want to control everything. You don't want to a completed script. You don't want, you know, like you said, directing a film like in the traditional way. You want to leave space for things to happen that you probably didn't plan for, and then they're exciting.
I guess this makes sense. I mean, it's a struggle, because I also have a very highly controlling personality, and I also want to like craft things and make them, you know, work as best as possible. So it's really a struggle between both impulses. But that's partially why I love working with actors, because with actors, you know, I feel like you can be very, very precise in your method and in the way you're working with them and the conversation you're having with them and what you're building together. But then, you know, because they're human beings, they're going to bring in whatever, you know, at the same time. So there's something exciting there to me. And I'm not interested in, you know, in these kind of projects, I don't really direct them when we're shooting. That's what I love. I actually love the fact that it's possible to work with. Before this, I work a lot with them, but then when it's shooting, I'm not telling them do this, do that. You know, I'm just letting them do whatever. And it's exciting when this works, because you feel like, okay, then that is balanced somehow. This kind of impulse is balanced.
It's similar to a technique by this theater director, Suzuki, who rehearses with actors for like months and months, doing like mostly physical exercises. And then they don't actually rehearse the play itself. They could be doing like Shakespeare. And then he's like, okay, now do Shakespeare. And
right.
And there's something about like the physical work over a period of time that they learn something unconsciously, becomes second nature. And then you trust the process, and you're going to see the benefits of that.
Yeah,
so I see
sense.
Some similarity there. I wanted to ask you about your recent piece, The Infinite Hip Hop Song. What is the concept behind that, and what makes the song infinite? It seems like there's a shift here from chaos to infinity, perhaps, or maybe we're talking about infinite chaos.
Yeah. Well, okay. First, the Infinite Hip Hop Song started as a music installation, and that's the concert is not infinite, obviously, because it's live. But the installation version is potentially, you know, very, very, very long. Basically, the way it's structured is that it's an algorithmic generator that works with a database that I produced. So the database is very limited, but the algorithm, of course, you know, but the algorithmic generator, because of the way it was programmed, which was done like with the computer music programmer and composer, Olivier Pasquier, that I worked closely with to do this, the way it's programmed allows it to create, you know, infinite or like very, 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 very long variations on this material to produce a song that is, you know, is not looping, is constantly changing, potentially infinitely, you know. And I was always also fascinated with this idea or image of the possibility of a song that doesn't end. And I was not a hip hop fan when I was, you know, younger. I became interested in hip hop in around 2016, 2015, 2016. Of course, I knew hip hop and also in the 90s, and I had friends who were into it, but it wasn't like a big deal for me. But I think around that time, again, like Egyptian hip hop started like mutating and becoming interesting and moving away from, it was very, very lame before that. But then it started becoming interesting for a period, and it caught my attention. And also it felt like it was a form that made sense with the moment, you know? Like I feel that it's a form because of its reliance on this attitude of the lack of embarrassment, this kind of like attitude where the ego is center stage with no shame, with no shame. That sort of makes sense with the moment in some ways. And again, I'm not speaking about this critically or not. It's just like an observation. And so when this form resonates or resonated to me, it felt like I was interested in working with it. And also like, yeah, I listen to hip hop now all the time. So that changed, that really changed. And so the music installation was done in this way, and the lyrics, again, it's this like trying to do it in my own language, and there is really also a level of hubris there, to take formats that are collectively produced and just to say, lay claim to them and try to work with them in your own language. There is a level of hubris there, which I admit to, but the lyrics were written, so all the lyrics were written, for this piece. There were 10 songs, but the lyrics are modular. So they were written with the idea that you can like take any sentence from any part and it will work with the next sentence from any of the other songs. The songs were all also written with this idea of a voice that is kind of collective in the sense that it's decentered and collective. So it's like it's not genderless, but it's like kind of like all genders, or it's not happening here or there. It kind of shifts geographically. It shifts also in terms of the perspective. So it's kind of like the ambition is a little bit trying to create a decentered voice that is kind of shifting, that in a way to try to tap into a global condition. That's
Sounds like God a little bit, like the voice of
like
God,
what?
the voice of God,
I don't know,
an
man. No.
omnipresent.
I don't know if it's on. It's not. It's actually, I'm thinking of it as the voice of us, like
The
of the
people,
collective.
yeah.
Yeah, in a way, or trying. Or actually, I don't know if it's the voice of. It's not the voice of people. It's like trying to touch the conditions, the shared conditions. And to do this, I felt it just needed to be the where the voice comes from should be as decentered as possible. I don't know if that's possible or not. That was the ambition. So the lyrics were written in those kind of in this logic. And I worked with like 11 rappers in the studio. I also did a form of casting, and then I worked with them and basically produced these sessions without originally I wanted to do them just with a metronome click, but that was too difficult. So we had like kind of like ready-made beats just for the studio, but they're not what I use in the installation. They're just kind of guides so that you have certain BPMs, certain keys, certain like so then these modules of vocal units, they were all cut up into vocal units, then can come together with the beats, and there's a logic which puts these things together, and then the song kind of plays and keeps changing. And the live version finally in 20 which premiered last year, 2022, I also worked with Olivier. I asked him to develop an interface for me that I can use so that I can take out the algorithmic generator, and then I can perform. I can enter this database of beats, bass lines, melodies, and vocals, and make the piece itself. And then I take, so basically the project went from human to, producing material, giving it to an algorithmic generator that is programmed in a certain way that puts it together and plays it, and then taking it back, creating an interface where the human is back and is controlling that material. And this was not really planned, but that's what happened. And I think that this changed my relationship to this material for sure. I think if I tried to make, you know, a hip hop set or an album or something like that directly, it would have been totally different. It would have been a totally different experience. I think this path of going, you know, creating something for an algorithmic system and then taking it back and then playing it, I don't know what it does exactly, but it changes the relationship. And it's exciting for me, actually. I feel like every time I perform this piece, there's something very exciting. I'm going to perform it next month in Cairo, so I'm very psyched about
Oh, that's
that.
cool. A lot of complexity, a lot of open possibilities. You know, I don't know if you're familiar with Lamont Young's
Yeah, of
Dream
course.
House. Have you
Sure.
been to that installation?
I actually do not remember if I've been in person or not, because I've been to New York many times over the
Yeah.
years. So either I've been in person or I've seen it. It feels a bit like a dream, but I
Yeah.
know it and I know the music and yeah.
It's like an infinite composition, basically, that's been going on for
Yeah.
like probably more than 20 years, and
Yes.
it's using drones, and you know, where you are in the room, it changes what you hear and
Changes.
all of that. It's fascinating. So that's what came to my mind when I thought about your piece as well. So my last question, what are you working on these days? Is there anything else you want to talk about or highlight? I know you have several publications out, such as The Anthology of Published and Unpublished Writings and Novella 12 Clues. So sort of what are you working on now, and what are some other things that you want to sort of you want the audience to be aware of about your work?
I'm preparing for an exhibition next year in Frankfurt at Porticus. I teach in Frankfurt, actually. So it's kind of like, so, and this exhibition will be based upon my graphics course. So, you know, we didn't discuss this, but I've also done scores for ensembles and for voice and for different kind of things, and they've been performed. And so the exhibition is taking, and for these like scores, they're not like classical notation, they're really graphic scores. And they do include, you know, pitch sequences, they do include specific musical instructions. So they're not just like an abstract kind of drawing and like given to the musician and just interpret that. They're not like that. They do have a system, but it's a made up system. And then, you know, I work with the musicians to decipher that system. You know, that's also another process.
That's pretty cool.
But this exhibition is going to try to translate these scores into artworks. So, you know, I'm a little bit stuck with this right now. It's not super clear how this is going to happen. This exhibition is in June next year. So I'm in the
Sure.
process of working on it. And hopefully there will be concerts to accompany the exhibition of these pieces. So that would be interesting, especially that I'm going to rearrange. You know, one of the pieces will be based on the soundtrack, the last soundtrack I did for Ahmad Al-Attar, which, you know, there were pieces that involved voice and percussion and piano and different things like this. And I kind of like that soundtrack, and I want to rearrange it into like one piece that will be performed live with saxophones. I mean, because we're in the studio, you know, there's like 12 saxophones, like creating like drone structures, and then melodies on top, and then vocals, like 16 voices in the back. It's really kind of massive. And I want to recreate this massiveness on stage, especially as the music is based upon this idea of a procession somehow, but it's a procession onto, not doom, it's not doom, but yeah, I don't know, it's hard to explain what it's a procession towards, you know, the play ends with this moment where these two families descend, like these two bourgeois families descend into total racism as the Swedish and Syrian family, and they're like start, you know, calling each other the worst things possible, and sort of this layer erupts. And this procession is for me kind of like a joyful procession into that layer. And that's partially, you know, this layer is very ugly, of course, these like, you know, racist hatred, etc. And we see it in the world. But I do believe that that layer cannot be ignored. And we have to engage with this, you know, the same place where this kind of ugly violence and cruelty comes, is also a place where something important lives. And I think maybe the only way to counter this craziness, it's not the only way, I mean, I'm speaking so metaphysically, which is dangerous as well. There's of course like politics, there's of course economics, I'm not denying that. But on a certain level that has to do with symbolic structures and has to do with how we operate as people, there is something that's in this layer that is not addressed. And I think progressive forces are unable to address this layer, while right-wing forces are able to address this layer very well. So I don't know, I veered off topic here, but there is something there that that piece of music is related to this idea somehow. And I want to rearrange it and, present
like
it.
Political like polarization today, in a sense?
Yeah, I mean, maybe I'm not so clear when I keep saying this layer. But, I mean, the place where hatred comes from and, this kind of like I mentioned racism, etc., or like these feelings of colonial dominance or whatever it is, xenophobia or, all these very ugly emotions, but they are culled from, they're emotional. They are, what are they? They're a sort of emotional ammunition. And where they come from, that place in us where they come from, which is related to anger also, is not, or I would say one of the tragedies, political tragedies of contemporary life is the inability to address that area in a way that is progressive. In a way, it seems that fascist tendencies, right-wing tendencies, racist tendencies are all addressed, and political forces, capitalize on that to create this kind of hatred and sense of dominance or whatever it is, while the opposite kind of urge, which exists in discourse, ideas of creating a more equitable society or, whatever, these ideas of living in different ways, are unable to address that part of us as human beings. And so I don't know. I mean, this music is not going to do that, but
you know,
like, it comes
Walter
from this.
Walter Benjamin spoke about how fascists aestheticize politics, and how the anti-fascist solution is to politicize aesthetics. So perhaps maybe this touches upon a little bit, because it's a long struggle, right?
Of course, except that this is true, but it's like to politicize aesthetics. Yeah, I guess it's in a way, but maybe aesthetics is deeper than we think. Maybe that's it. Aesthetics is not just what things look like.
Right.
Aesthetics, I think, it's a deeper thing than what we think it is. That's my feeling. Or maybe the word is not right, but I don't know. Anyway, it's whatever. I really hope this conversation makes sense to people, because it
I'm
feels
sure it will. I'm sure it will.
Yeah.